Chapter 27. The next sitting opened on Thursday, the 1st of March. 58 judges present, the others resting. As usual, Joan was required to take an oath without reservations. She showed no temper this time. She considered herself well buttressed by the process verbal compromise which Cochin was so anxious to repudiate and creep out of, so she merely refused, distinctly and decidedly, and added, in a spirit of fairness and candor, "But as to matters set down in the process verbal, I will freely tell the whole truth, yes, as freely and fully, as if I were before the Pope." Here was a chance. We had two or three popes then. Only one of them could be the true Pope, of course. Everybody judiciously shirked the question of which was the true Pope and refrained from naming him, it being clearly dangerous to go into particulars in this matter. Here was an opportunity to trick an unadvised girl into bringing herself into peril, and the unfair judge lost no time in taking advantage of it. He asked, in a plausibly indolent and absent way, "Which one do you consider to be the true Pope?" The house took an attitude of deep attention, and so waited to hear the answer, and see the prey walk into the trap. But when the answer came, it covered the judge with confusion, and you could see many people covertly chuckling. For Joan asked in a voice and manner which almost deceived even me, so innocent it seemed, "Are there two? One of the ablest priests in that body and one of the best swearers there," spoke right out, so that half the house heard him, and said, "By God, it was a master stroke." As soon as the judge was better of his embarrassment, he came back to the charge, but was prudent, and passed by Joan's question, "Is it true that you received a letter from the Count of Armagnac asking you which of the three popes he ought to obey?" "Yes," and answered it. Copies of both letters were produced and read. Joan said that hers had not been quite strictly copied. She said as he had received the Count's letter when she was just mounting her horse, and added, "So, in dictating a word or two of reply, I said I would try to answer him from Paris or somewhere where I could be addressed." She was asked again which Pope as he had considered the right one. "I was not able to instruct the Count of Armagnac as to which one he ought to obey," then she added, with a frank fearlessness which sounded fresh and wholesome in that den of trimmers and shufflers, "but as for me, I hold that we are bound to obey our Lord the Pope who is at Rome." The matter was dropped. They produced and read a copy of Joan's first effort at dictating her proclamation summoning the English to retire from the siege of Orleans and vacate France, truly a great and fine production for an unpracticed girl of 17. "Do you acknowledge as your own the document which has just been read?" "Yes, except that there are errors in it, words which make me give myself too much importance." I saw what was coming. I was troubled and ashamed. If, for instance, I did not say deliver up to the maid, her end is la p-u-c-e-l-l-e less than greater than, I said deliver up to the king, her end is a roi, and I did not call myself commander-in-chief, chef de guerre, all those are words which my secretary substituted. Or mayhap he misheard me, or forgot what I said. She did not look at me when she said it. She spared me that embarrassment. I hadn't misheard her at all, and hadn't forgotten. I changed her language purposely, for she was commander-in-chief, and entitled to call herself so, and it was becoming and proper too, and who was going to surrender anything to the king? At that time a stick, a cipher? If any surrendering was done, it would be to the noble maid of Vaucouleurs, already famed and formidable, though as he had not yet struck a blow. Ah, there would have been a fine and disagreeable episode for me there, if that pitiless court had discovered that the very scribbler of that piece of dictation, secretary to Joan of Arc, was present and not only present, but helping build the record. And not only that, but destined at a far distant day to testify against lies and perversions smuggled into it by caution and deliver them over to eternal infamy. Do you acknowledge that you dictated this proclamation? I do. Have you repented of it? Do you retract it? Ah, then she was indignant. No. Not even these chains, and she shook them, not even these chains can chill the hopes that I uttered there. And more. She rose, and stood a moment with a divine strange light kindling in her face, then her words burst forth as in a flood, warn you now that before 7 years a disaster will smite the English, oh, manyfold greater than the fall of Orleans. And, silence. Sit down. And then, soon after, they will lose all France. Now consider these things. The French armies no longer existed. The French cause was standing still, our king was standing still, there was no hint that by and by the Constable Richmond would come forward, and take up the great work of Joan of Arc and finish it. In face of all this, Joan made that prophecy, made it with perfect confidence, and it came true. For within 5 years Paris fell 1436, and our king marched into it flying the victor's flag. So the first part of the prophecy was then fulfilled, in fact, almost the entire prophecy. For, with Paris in our hands, the fulfillment of the rest of it was assured. 20 years later all France was ours excepting a single town, Calais. Now that will remind you of an earlier prophecy of Joan's. At the time that she wanted to take Paris, and could have done it with ease, if our king had but consented, she said that that was the golden time, that, with Paris ours, all France would be ours in 6 months. But if this golden opportunity to recover France was wasted, said she, I give you 20 years to do it in. She was right. After Paris fell, in 1436, the rest of the work had to be done city by city, castle by castle, and it took 20 years to finish it. Yes, it was the first day of March, 1431, there in the court, that she stood in the view of everybody, and uttered that strange and incredible prediction. Now and then, in this world, somebody's prophecy turns up correct, but when you come to look into it there is sure to be considerable room for suspicion that the prophecy was made after the fact. But here the matter is different. There in that court Joan's prophecy was set down in the official record at the hour and moment of its utterance, years before the fulfillment, and there you may read it to this day. 25 years after Joan's death the record was produced in the great court of the Rehabilitation, and verified under oath by Manchin and me, and surviving judges of our court, confirmed the exactness of the record in their testimony. Joan's startling utterance on that now, so celebrated 1st of March stirred up a great turmoil, and it was some time before it quieted down again. Naturally, everybody was troubled, for a prophecy is a grisly and awful thing, whether one thinks it ascends from hell or comes down from heaven. All that these people felt sure of was, that the inspiration back of it was genuine and puissant. They would have given their right hands to know the source of it. At last the questions began again. How do you know that those things are going to happen? I know it by revelation. And I know it as surely as I know that you sit here before me. This sort of answer was not going to allay the spreading uneasiness. Therefore, after some further dallying the judge got the subject out of the way, and took up one which he could enjoy more. What languages do your voices speak? French. Saint Marguerite too? Verily, why not? She is on our side, not on the English. Saints and angels who did not condescend to speak English is a grave affront. They could not be brought into court and punished for contempt, but the tribunal could take silent note of Joan's remark, and remember it against her, which they did. It might be useful by and by. Do your saints and angels wear jewelry? Crowns, rings, earrings? To Joan, questions like these were profane frivolities, and not worthy of serious notice, she answered indifferently. But the question brought to her mind another matter, and she turned upon caution and said, I had 2 rings. They have been taken away from me during my captivity. You have one of them. It is the gift of my brother. Give it back to me. If not to me, then I pray that it be given to the church. The judges conceived the idea that maybe these rings were for the working of enchantments. Perhaps they could be made to do Joan a damage. Where is the other ring? The Burgundians have it. Where did you get it? My father and mother gave it to me. Describe it. It is plain and simple, and has Jesus and Mary engraved upon it. Everybody could see that that was not a valuable equipment to do devil's rock with. So that trail was not worth following. Still, to make sure, one of the judges asked Joan if she had ever cured sick people by touching them with the ring. She said no. Now as concerning the fairies that were used to abide nearby Domremy, whereof there are many reports and traditions. It is said that your godmother surprised these creatures on a summer's night dancing under the tree called El Arbor Feet of Borlmont. Is it not possible that your pretended saints and angels are but those fairies? Is that in your process? She made no other answer. Have you not conversed with Saint Marguerite and Saint Catherine under that tree? I do not know. Or by the fountain near the tree? Yes, sometimes. What promises did they make you? None but such as they had God's warrant for. But what promises did they make? That is not in your process. Yet I will say this much. They told me that the king would become master of his kingdom in spite of his enemies. And what else? There was a pause, then she said humbly, they promised to lead me to paradise. If faces do really betray what is passing in men's minds, a fear came upon many in that house, at this time, that maybe, after all, a chosen servant and herald of God was here being hunted to her death. The interest deepened. Movements and whispering ceased. The stillness became almost painful. Have you noticed that almost from the beginning the nature of the questions asked Joan showed that in some way or other the questioner very often already knew his fact before he asked his question? Have you noticed that somehow or other the questioners usually knew just how and were to search for Joan's secrets, that they really knew the bulk of her privacies, a fact not suspected by her, and that they had no task before them but to trick her into exposing those secrets? Do you remember Loiseleur, the hypocrite, the treacherous priest, tool of caution? Do you remember that under the sacred seal of the confessional Joan freely and trustingly revealed to him everything concerning her history save only a few things regarding her supernatural revelations which her voices had forbidden her to tell to anyone, and that the unjust judge, Cauchon, was a hidden listener all the time? Now you understand how the inquisitors were able to devise that long array of minutely prying questions. Questions whose subtlety and ingenuity and penetration are astonishing until we come to remember Loiseleur's performance and recognize their source. Ah, Bishop of Beauvais, you are now lamenting this cruel iniquity these many years in hell. Yes, verily, unless one has come to your help. There is but one among the redeemed that would do it, and it is futile to hope that that one has not already done it, Joan of Arc. We will return to the questionings. Did they make you still another promise? Yes, but that is not in your process. I will not tell it now, but before 3 months I will tell it you. The judge seems to know the matter he is asking about already. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.